This is MIT SHASS Radio. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Kathleen. A few years ago, Beth Delvecchio went multiple days without eating. She had no food in her house and no way of getting any.
So my most difficult time was I went on a four-day stretch with no food here, where I'm located at, where I'm living. So I went to bed hungry for four nights and woke up hungry for 4 days. That was the worst. I can now understand hunger.
Unfortunately, Beth's situation is not unique. At MIT alone, roughly 11% of MIT students say they go to bed hungry at least one night out of seven because they don't have enough money for food.
And although food insecurity has been a problem all throughout history, we have seen it become amplified ever since the recession in 2008.
One solution to this problem has been a growth in the urban farming movement across the United States as homeowners attempt to take the problem into their own hands.
Together, Kirsten and I have worked with Kate Brown, a professor of science, technology, and society here at MIT. We studied the impacts of urban farming and the ways it's benefiting communities around our nation.
Specifically, I've been focusing on the laws and initiatives impacting certain cities of Cleveland, Detroit, and Baltimore, and Kathleen has gone out into the community and dug into the personal effects and community values that have spurred from this movement.
So first, we'd like to introduce the definition of urban farming. In general, urban farming is the production of food in an urban setting. Often, this involves transforming vacant lots into farms and gardens that serve the community. The fruit produced might go directly to the farmers, community members, or local restaurants. And Kirsten, you mentioned that you were exploring the laws and initiatives regarding urban farming. Could you share a bit about what you've learned and if there's anything in particular that you found interesting?
For sure. So over the past 10 years, there has been rapid growth of the urban farming movement, so much that up to 27% of cities within the US and Canada have started initiatives.
Wow, 27%. What cities did you look at specifically?
Well, looking back on the movement as a whole, I found that there were about 18,000 community gardens in both the Canada and US. And with about 100 gardens per city, that would mean that there's about 180 totals with urban farming laws. And with about 900 major cities within the US and Canada, that's where I got my 27% number. And the most fascinating cities I found were Baltimore, Cleveland, and Detroit.
What sort of initiatives did these cities implement?
Well, specifically, they had some of the most well-funded and widespread programs out of all the cities I've looked at. Baltimore's land leasing initiative, in which you got to rent out land for intervals of like 1 year, 5 years, sometimes up to 10 years, made it easy to get started with urban farming and was one of the first cities to implement such a program. Cleveland overall implemented laws in 2007 and are some of the best urban farming initiatives out there, which I'm sure we'll hear a bit more on because I know that was something you focused on, Kathleen. And Detroit has over 1,000 urban farms. That is extremely large in comparison to most cities averaging only 50 to 100 farms.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. It sounds like these laws are designed to incentivize urban farming in each of their respective cities. Do you think the pressure to create these laws is coming from the communities or is it coming from the states in order to promote more urban farming?
That's a question I struggled with a little bit during my project because I couldn't really tell at first. But ultimately, though, I think a majority of these laws have been a response by officials to what the community has been doing. For example, the laws in Detroit didn't come about until many urban farms had already been established. And even then, they still don't cover the full extent for what Detroit farmers are seeking.
Interesting. Were there any negative impacts of these laws? What do you mean that they still don't cover the full extent of what Detroit farmers are seeking?
What I mean is that sometimes the laws tend to cause harm rather than help. I discovered an article from Curb Detroit that outlined a scenario in which Detroit livestock owners' animals became illegal after the initial urban farming laws were implemented because the laws weren't broad enough. Animals they had previously kept legally were suddenly illegal, and they had been fighting to have this amended for a few years but have had no luck from officials.
Wow. So along this thread, I spoke with Mark White, who is the operations manager at an urban farm in Cleveland, Ohio, and their farm is called the Rid All Green Partnership. I asked him about his thoughts on these kinds of laws, and he gave some interesting insight.
I think that the people have to get their minds around the whole transient idea. You know, cities are constantly changing. You know, as I say, you know, these things are transient. It's like houses were in a neighborhood at one time. Now it's roads, and then it's apartments, then it's something else. A city, when you live in a city, you're subject to the changes that come along with the city. It just goes with the territory. The thing is, you want more permanent, you have to have more rural property. It just goes with the territory. So I say a five-year increment, I mean, you know, that's cool as long as you know on the front end what's happening. But like I say, the bottom line is to try to repair the soil and to allow that whole regenerative process to take place. Everywhere you are, you're going to leave that land better than it was when you found it. At the end of the day, a lot of farms, you know, can become mobile in terms of the soil. You create your soil, you know, you can have containers, you know, you can move the farm in containers. I think people have to think like that now, especially in the urban environment, and especially in our contemporary society.
So essentially, cities are constantly changing, and I think the urban farming laws reflect that. They may not be perfect in that they don't cover everyone's needs, or that they lead to unintended consequences like maybe mobile farms, but both communities and officials are adapting and learning from one another, and that itself is reflected within the laws.
I think Mark's ideas about mobile farms are really interesting, and I want to dig into that a little more. After all, so much of farming is about soil, and as Mark said, soil is transportable.
The raised bed can be moved somewhere else. You know, because it's like anything, it's like many of the people in our country now are people from other places. You know, we don't have a land ownership base any longer. You know, some people own land here in America, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, you know, coming from around the world, America's a melting pot. And so, you know, people's strength is based on their land. And so if you don't have land, you're like a potted plant anyway. You know what I'm saying? So the people are potted plants, essentially, you know, because they're not tied into the land.
Kirsten, what do you think about this idea of mobile people and mobile farms? Do you think that they're a way around some of the laws implemented in cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and Baltimore?
I think it's an interesting idea and ties back to what we sort of mentioned earlier about how communities are adapting to the urban farming laws in the same way that officials are adapting to what the community responds with. Because laws were set for limited timeframes, the people adapted and realized they need to become mobile. So in a way, it is a workaround for some of the laws implemented in that they take the land with them. But people are always on the move, and land ownership isn't quite as prominent as it once was. And I think it's just a part of modern life, and it's something that we will continue to see even if urban farming laws became more permanent.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Another important aspect of urban farming is the lasting impact it has on the community. Urban farms such as the Riddall Initiative in Cleveland, where Mark works, play an important role in community engagement. Many provide opportunities for employment, skill development, and education on gardening and healthy living. Here's what Mark had to say on this.
We actually provide 9 jobs in the community right now and a host of jobs throughout the year. From, you know, like we say, you know, we open our doors for volunteer opportunities and for also employment. You know, we educate over 4,000 people a year that come through our gates. It really is a big, you know, impact in terms of, you know, demonstrating what's possible in the urban core environment.
Another major impact is perhaps the most direct one of urban farming: the fact that they can provide food for local community members. We'll come back to Beth's story now. As we heard, she has struggled with food insecurity. Beth lives in rural Iowa, so perhaps her garden falls slightly beyond the urban farming definition, but it's relevant nonetheless. Here's her story about her hardest period without food.
Right, so it was during the winter, So I couldn't, it was a real bad winter that winter, and that 2019 winter. And that was actually the beginning of it. I stand corrected that actually happened to me again here. So I had two incidences where I went multiple days without eating. But the first time was in the winter. And in fact, there were some, you might find this funny, I don't know, but it's really not funny in the moment. But there were actually some canned foods down in the basement of this house. And I started rummaging through them. And I did find one that was dated adequately for consumption. And so, yeah, I tore into that. A lot of it was not dated for consumption, so I didn't want to harm myself, you know. But that was right. One of my ways of survival, I guess you could say, looking for another alternative since I couldn't get out of the house here because of the winter.
Beth's case is fairly extreme, but food insecurity is universal. Kirsten, do you have any statistics on the prevalence of food insecurity here in the United States?
I do, actually. So in 2019 alone, about 35 million people struggled with hunger in the U.S., and about 9% of the population would go to bed on an empty stomach every night. At MIT alone, about 11% of students don't have enough money for food and go to bed hungry one night out of seven as a result.
Wow. Thanks for sharing those numbers, Kirsten. 35 million people is a pretty significant portion of our population.
Community movements such as urban farming can perhaps help reduce these numbers. I asked Beth about how it feels to have her own garden, where she grows tomatoes and peppers.
It made me feel secure. Even though there were a couple times where all I had was the tomatoes and green peppers for maybe a couple days, at least I had that. I can't, unless you've been there, I can't explain hunger. A lot of it is also has to do with the psychological movement of just bringing food to your mouth. So I figured as long as I have the tomatoes and green peppers, I would still be able to eat.
Stories like Beth's are so encouraging to hear. They show the direct impact that gardens have on people who can't afford or don't have access to enough food. And Beth's garden did not only provide nourishment, but it empowered her. She feels more confident, more secure, and less hungry.
Here's Beth's message to other people who might be thinking of starting their own garden, whether they live in a rural area or a city.
So to have access to land and to not do anything with it, use it for what it's there for, which I believe it's there to plant and grow. People with little areas could actually still create gardens. You can turn your city front yard into a garden. So, yeah, I wish I could encourage the whole world to do that. It's work. But, you know, nothing good comes easy. You have to work hard for things, you know, and a lot of people want the easy way out. They want to just open up a can and pour it in the bowl, you know, and so I'm willing to do the work. And I know a lot of other people are too. So for those that are willing to do the work, I just recommend this coming spring to start digging up some dirt and planting some seeds, you know, and watch it grow and go out your back door and grab your food at your convenience.
So now that we've seen laws and initiatives surrounding urban farming and the impact it can have on individuals and communities, I think the real question is, where do we think urban farming is going? Kathleen?
Yeah, I think one idea is the concept of vertical farming, where a lot of farming, instead of being horizontal and using up a lot of land space, instead they build skyscrapers of a sort in which plants are stacked on top of each other and it uses up less space.
Oh, that's really cool. So you kind of see that the vacant lots that they've been taking now potentially turning into like future farm skyscrapers.
Mm-hmm. And that would also help with increased population density and all the issues associated with that.
Yeah, and I think along with that, this is going to bring out a rise of more research into meat substitutes and plant-based alternatives, because like, you know, we can't have that much livestock within cities, no matter how high we'd be able to go, just because I don't think that's how population works, but ultimately, I think we'll see a growth in people becoming more vegetarian from this.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And even the carbon impacts of livestock as we kind of move towards a stricter climate and carbon budget, we'll have to find alternatives to those. And I also think that an important way that things might change is with gene editing. There's been a lot of pushback against GMOs, but cutting edge science has shown that you can use gene editing to make more efficient organisms, and that includes plants. So I think we might find new ways to make plants use nutrients or water more efficiently.
Yeah, and then that in turn would also kind of address back to the whole vertical farming and making the most out of the space you have too. I think it's a really interesting concept, and I can't wait to see where it goes. Just like I honestly can't wait to see where urban farming as a movement as a whole is going. I think we will continue to see exponential growth and possibly a shift to a more healthy lifestyle within cities as a whole.
Mm-hmm. That would definitely be an important benefit of urban farming. Mm-hmm. And so lastly, as we wrap things up, we want to acknowledge the people who helped make this podcast possible. So this includes Kate Brown, our professor and mentor, who so willingly offered her insight, guidance, and time throughout this entire process. And Mark White and Beth DelVecchio, who agreed to share their time and offer their unique perspectives over phone interviews. Megan Black and Tristan Brown, professors at MIT, who helped support this project and offered invaluable direction along the way. Thank you, and thank you for listening.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.